going down there. If you can make the insertion loss go to zero by making a superconductor, silver plated, or whatever, then the Q would go up. That is the loss mechanism that limits the Q. If you can make the loss go to zero, then the Q will go to infinity. So it is a transmission line that is a resonant length, and because you've made the electrical length just right, electronically a quarter wavelength in this particular example, the signal is going to bounce back and forth 5,000 times, stay in phase, stay co-phase, stay locked together on each individual bounce, and there'll be 5,000 of them before the signal gets dissipated. You could actually measure it when it drops. You can measure the Q of the cavity by slowly swishing the frequency and finding out what is the bandwidth. Once you know the center frequency, divide by bandwidth. That's one definition of Q. You could also measure rise time and fall time. Some people call it ring down time. You put a signal on there, you remove the signal, and you watch the output of the cavity and watch how long it takes to ring down. Go to the right equation, that will tell you Q. But as you can see, a reentrant cavity resonator is a piece of very low loss, usually air-filled transmission line, coaxial transmission line, with shorts and opens on the ends so the signal can bounce back and forth. Make the loss low enough, and the Q goes to infinity. So the exact diameter, the exact volume, doesn't matter. You're making it large in volume, you're making it out of copper, so that as a transmission line, its insertion loss is very low. That's what gives it the very sharp tuning and the very high Q. Ain't that interesting there, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, extremely interesting. I went on eBay and a few other sites to see if I could buy one. There was nothing available in the 2-meter range, so I probably will have to build something that you're describing. And I was looking to get some 4 or 5 inch copper pipe at that length, and that I'm going to have. I'll just have to hunt it, but I'll be able to get that. Then what I have to do is actually figure out how I connect the cables to it, what kind of fittings to use, things like that. The entrance points, are they going to be at the bottom, at the top? I know that really doesn't matter, but I want to make sure, because once this thing is put together, it would be difficult to disassemble it, to do anything to it. But I see how the tuning is accomplished with the screw on top, and interesting construct. Not much there, but I can see how it works. Back to you, Dick.
I came over him beautifully, and I can see by the signal strength I'm hearing on the input, he's now running S5 on 2.5. He's traveling back toward New York City, and he's flipping the frequency on which he's doing his thing. This guy is a very troubled individual. Obvious by the fact he can do this all hours of the day and night, I'm reasonably sure he is unemployed. And he's a beautiful example of a famous French saying, a man alone with his own thoughts is in bad company. So I wonder how many non-friends this guy has that he thinks he's going to get recognition of some kind by doing this or get some kind of pleasure out of it. It's sad. So once you realize the theory of operation, it is simply a transmission line that is exactly electronically a quarter wavelength long, with your variable capacitor at the end or your variable tuning rod at the end. And the size of those coupling loops and their proximity to the center conductor gives you the coupling coefficient. So as you made the loops closer to the center conductor and or larger in diameter, you have tighter coupling to that resonator. There's an ideal amount of coupling to the resonator. Make it too light and you get a reasonably large insertion loss. Make it too heavy, the coupling coefficient, by making the loops too big and too close. Let me drop. Make the coupling loops too big and too close, where the coupling coefficient is too heavy. The good news is the insertion loss becomes very small. The bad news is now the tuning becomes very broad. So when you're building a cavity resonator filter, you usually want the sharpest tuning you can possibly get with the least amount of insertion loss at the passband frequency. As you can tell, there's a bit of a conflict there. Heavier coupling, less loss, but broader tuning. Lighter coupling, sharper tuning, but more insertion loss. And somewhere in between those two extremes, there's a happy medium. The usual happy medium, with that method of construction, the usual happy medium that everyone settles for when they're building these kind of cavity resonator filters for a duplexing filter for a repeater, the usual rule of thumb they settle for is roughly half a dB insertion, half a dB insertion loss per cavity. And that gives you a certain amount of decibels of rejection of the adjacent frequency that you don't want. I can tell he's moving back toward the repeater. He's getting stronger there, and a little weaker to me. So, anybody on the Long Island Expressway, go take a look for this guy. So, there's a happy medium uncoupling coefficient. Now, when it comes to really building one, by way of the diagrams I've shown you, you see the theory of operation, and you see various ways of building it, John. What I recommend is that there are manuals you can buy from QST, from ARRL. There are websites that will show you construction techniques. So the next level, now that you understand how it works, and yes, you could build one, you need to go through the learning curve of maybe making a couple of mistakes and before getting it right. You could bypass many of those mistakes by choosing the right website that shows you how to choose exactly the right materials. There are construction articles that can be found that give you a real recipe as to how to do it. Let me drop for a second and take a listen to the other frequency. Sure enough, he's now flipped over to the other frequency. Well, I know he's traveling east and going to jam the eastern input. Poor guy, he needs a hobby. So I do recommend that before you actually go and buy materials, John, that we find for you a real construction article where people have done it. There are hundreds of hams out there scattered throughout the United States that have homebrewed the cavity resonator filters for a full operational duplexer filter network for a repeater. I'd much rather see you follow somebody else's successful recipe rather than re-derive one yourself. Yes, you now see the theory of operation, and without a doubt you can build one. But you can make it one or two steps a little bit more convenient if we find a construction article for you. Over to you, John. KC2W.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm interested in maybe it would be more effective and a little easier to make the outer cylinder out of two pieces, telescoping, until I could get perfect tuning. But I have another question on the input and output loops that you see in one pictorial at the bottom of the cavity. There are the inserting loop and the outer loop, outgoing loop. Are those specifically quarter wavelength, eighth wavelength? How are they determined? What is their length? How effective is the length adjustment on those?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked questions, John. You definitely do not want to telescope the outer. Do not telescope the outer. You're going to make the outer long enough. And by the way, if you made the outer twice as long as it's required, nothing bad would happen. It's only the length of the inner conductor, the 2-inch diameter pipe in your example, that's what determines the resonance. The outer one there is just the outer conductor of a transmission line, so to speak, and at the open end, it represents a shielding structure. So the exact length of the outer doesn't matter. Do not telescope it. The only thing you do telescope is the inner. The high impedance end, the non-grounded end of the inner, usually has a finger-stocked mounted plunger, but by way of the threaded rod going down the center of the whole structure, you're able to, from the outside, turn that rod and push that plunger in and out. That is the fine-tuning of frequency. And so that quarter wave, that rod being electronically quarter wavelength rod long, is the resonance. Now, the input coupling loop and the output coupling loop absolutely do not have any specific number of wavelengths of length.
timeout.
It really is an inductive coupling mechanism. Its exact length in wavelength doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the area of the loop. As the loop increases in area, because you've made it a little larger in diameter, or you've extended it a little bit along the length of the cavity, and or as the loop gets closer to the center conductor, the resonator, that's what determines the coupling coefficient. So by choosing the right area of loop, the right distance of loop to the center conductor, that determines the coupling coefficient. When you've got that set right, you'll have approximately half a dB insertion loss between the input coupler and the output coupling loop, and you'll have about as sharp a tuning you're going to get. Make the coupling lighter yet so you get more than half a dB of insertion loss. You don't pick up any more sharpness of tuning. Make it heavier and you pick up a little bit less insertion loss, but you also pick up a broader tuning. It's not quite as sharp as the tuning. Around half a dB insertion loss, when you get that, then you know your two coupling loops are approximately the right diameter and the right closeness. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the SetNet.
It does. Now, those could be a piece of finger stock, or they could just be a piece of wire coming out of an end connector or something like that. And I assume from the diagram, they look like they're 180 degrees opposed on opposite sides of the tuning area. Is that correct?
Yes, that is exactly right, John. The reason why you make them on 180 degrees is that you want all of the coupling from the input loop and the coupling to the output loop to go only through the resonator in the center. The input coupling loop launches some energy into the resonator. The energy you launch from the resonator bounces back and forth and does its resonance thing. Then that energy, because it's creating a strong magnetic field due to the resonance, due to the bouncing energy, near the bottom of that rod, it's creating a strong magnetic field that in turn couples to the output coupling loop. The reason why you put the two coupling loops, when you're looking at the whole thing top view, one's at 6 o'clock and one's at 12 o'clock, that's the place where you get the maximum shielding between the loops. Any coupling that goes directly from loop number one to loop number two without using the resonator is bypassing the resonator and is not giving you any tuning. So you get the best possible shielding when they're on opposite ends of that resonator. You could, if you want to, put one loop at 6 o'clock and one loop at 3 o'clock top view. I don't recommend that because now there would be some energy that can couple directly from one loop to the other without going through the resonator. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. But that brings up another question. Why couldn't one loop be connected directly to the resonator and the other loop freestanding? It sounds like that would be the same thing.
Yes, John. The main thing that makes it all work is the resonator in the center and its resonant frequency. Let me drop. That's what makes it all work. When it comes to mechanisms for coupling to the resonator, you can have the input connector go to a stiff piece of wire that goes over to the center conductor. Let me pick a number. An inch and a half above ground, and it solders directly to it. In other words, direct connection coupling. You can do that. Inductive coupling with a loop. You can do that. There's ways of capacitive coupling. In other words, you could have the input connector not mounted at the base, but input connector mounted 3 or 4 inches up on the side of the outer conductor, and a small gimmick coupling capacitor between the center conductor of the input connector and the resonator. So you can couple energy capacitively, directly, or inductively. Doesn't matter. They all work. The majority of people use inductive coupling because it gives it the most amount of leeway for tuning. By taking that input coupling loop and bending it a little bit closer, a little bit further away from the center conductor, you are changing the coupling coefficient very conveniently. If you were soldering it to the semiconductor, you'd have to go through the great big rigmarole of heating up a great big chunk of copper, melting that solder, moving the probe to another position, and then starting all over again. They all work equally efficiently, just that the coupling loop is much more convenient when it comes to tinkering. KC2WGB, KQLIW, the TechNet.
Very good. Sounds like an interesting project. Might have a lot of fun with this. I'll be able to get the materials, I know that, and it shouldn't be that difficult. All right. The other question is, being that it wouldn't be used strictly for the same use that you would use it at a repeater, because now we're looking, we don't need 120 dB of effective attenuation, because we're only going to be working with some milliwatts. Why doesn't a trap at the transmitted frequency work without going through this elaborate system? Maybe you could educate me on that.
There's a zillion ways that you and I can make filters, John. A simple inductor and a capacitor coupled to each other is a resonator. And then by the right coupling coefficient in there, by tapping some turns on the coil, or capacitive coupling or inductive coupling, there's all kinds of ways I can couple energy in and out. Making a bandpass filter is easy. Making a filter, and by the way, if I take a nice piece of, let me pick a number, 16-gauge wire, I wind it into a set of turns, I put the right kind of a capacitor across it so that it resonates at 146.85 or 25 megahertz, I can easily build that. And when I do that, what I just described, and I go and measure it, it'll probably have a Q of 50. When you've got a Q of 50, as opposed to this cavity resonator with a Q of 5,000, that's a 100-to-1 ratio of tuning resolution. When you're using a cavity filter of Q of 5,000 and you pass your desired frequency of 146.25 and you're down on the skirt of this very sharp filter and you're getting a whole lot of decibels of rejection of 146.85, that Q of 5,000 is really working for you. Whereas that simple inductor capacitor filter network looking like an IF can with a Q of 50, without a doubt, you can make it resonate very nicely at 146.25. And you can get, instead of 30 dB of rejection of 146.85, you'll get 3 dB of rejection because the filter is so broad. How broad is the filter? That's called Q. You divide the bandwidth of the filter into the center frequency, we call that Q. If your filter has got a Q of 5,000,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you've got a Q of 5,000, that means your filter has got a whole lot of ability to couple the desired frequency and put the undesired frequency down on the skirt of the filter because the filter is that sharp. How sharp a filter is its Q. And you and I want a Q of 5,000. You can't get it any other way except using very low loss materials with a lot of real estate. If you want to simultaneously have a miniature filter with very high Q, except for using very exotic barium tetratitanate materials, and that's a very difficult synthesis process, except for using very exotic materials, the only way you and I can do it conveniently is to start off with very low loss and real estate. You can't have it both ways, infinitesimal in size and infinite Q. Yeah. One negates the other, if you know what I mean. Maybe that's part of the answer you're looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, so to get that tremendous Q, we need a cavity filter, and nothing else is going to work. All right, that sounds good. And when I look at that, and I put the birdies on that waveform, I will see the attenuation of a Q of 5,000, or as close as I can get to it. All right. Yeah, sounds like a very interesting project. I'm going to be
Resonator has got the cue, but it can't tolerate the power. This method of construction can power eight, lots of high power with no problem. The only thing is it's going to be a little bit voluminous. It's going to be, you could possibly build it out of 7/8 inch diameter or 1¼ Andrew Heliacs, because the guys in Canada didn't do that. And they gave us, gave you and I an article on how they did that. And they did do that for 6 meters. On 2 meters, I'm not sure you're going to get enough Q by that technique, because it's the insertion loss of the signal flowing down, what you and I call the cavity resonator semiconductor. It really is a coaxial transmission line. So the amount of insertion loss the signal suffers as it goes down the transmission line determines what Q you're going to get. Makes that loss go to zero by using air line, large diameter, nice thick chunks of copper, and the loss is so low, the loss of the signal going down there is so low that it bounces back and forth a whole lot of times, and that's what you and I define as high Q. High Q is very desirable because it gives you sharp tuning and very little insertion loss at reasonable coupling coefficients. You've now had a couple of months worth of lessons on filter synthesis, John, all squeezed into a couple of days. I hope you appreciate that. There aren't very many books you can go to that'll give you all this information in one shot. KC2WGB, you might have some more questions. K2LIW in the TechNet.
505, that was me, so good. And I know
KC2WGB, what an idiot. One other question comes to mind. I just want to remind you, we're only looking at receiving, not transmission, so I don't think we have to worry too much about wattage or power. We're only going to be using it in our application for receiving. That should make a difference with how much power capability we need.
Yeah, from that you would think that you could build it out of quartz resonators. Looks like I'm going to have to flip back to the west again. We're going to keep him running back and forth in the expressway. Let me take a quick listen to see how strong he is on the input. Yeah, sure enough, he's heading east again. He's burning up quite a bit of gas, chasing after us, John. I'm keeping him running. Yes, I know you're only running milliwatts. However, to get a quartz resonator at the fifth and seventh overtone to give you the right kind of tuning that you desire, Up at 146 megs. You don't have enough knobs on that crystal resonator there, John. The quartz crystal, the good news is that properly used is very high in Q. The bad news is you can't move its frequency very much. Whereas this cavity resonator, you can move that thing to hell and gone by just tuning the length of the semiconductor for the right kind of a plunger mechanism at the end of the high voltage end of it. By changing that length, you can move the frequency anywhere you want. Quartz doesn't let you do that. So even though you're not transmitting, but don't sell yourself short. The day will come when you're going to want to transmit to this thing. I can give you some reason to believe that. So this method of construction gives you the Q, gives you the performance, even though you're only running at the milliwatt level in the receive mode. My goodness, is he enthusiastic. I'm hearing him continuously in the background, and I can tell he's traveling east again, because he realizes I'm going into the eastern input. Thank goodness there's a good number of miles between these two repeaters, therefore it takes him quite a length of time to go from one to the other. Sure wish we had a couple more guys on the Lunar Expressway tonight, but I think that's the way he's doing it. Alrighty, was there anything else I was going to tell you about cavity resonators? I think we've got to find a construction article, John. Now,
quick question, Dick.
Go right ahead with your quick question, John.
Recommend that the motion of the tuning be controlled with a non-threaded rod. Would that be easier, or do you think that should be a copper or a brass threaded device?
Electronically, that rod could be definitely made out of nylon, plastic, or whatever. But now you've got to worry about the next phenomenon. The good news about this cavity filter is it's very high in Q, very sharp in tuning. The next thing you've got to worry about is temperature coefficient. If you're really smart, you would make that threaded rod out of invar metal. A metal that has very little thermal expansion and contraction as a function of temperature. That rod, as you go from a hot day to a cold day, and hot day to a cold day might really be 2 degrees Fahrenheit change in the cavity resonator, if that rod is made out of materials with a high temperature coefficient, the rod is stretching and shrinking, the plunger at the end is moving, and your frequency is moving. So you got to be a little bit careful on the choice of materials if you want temperature stability. See where we're going on that one, John. And some people will intentionally use a variable capacitor at the end that is itself temperature sensitive, but with the opposite temperature coefficient in order to compensate. So the good news when you get a high Q cavity filter is sharp. The bad news is that because it's sharp, if it moves as a function of temperature, sometimes you're going to be a little bit unhappy. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
2WGB. Well, I think, Dick, with a 5,000 Q, if we lost, you know, a couple of thousandths of an inch, in my mind, I don't think we would lose that much of Q on that filter. And it's something to think about.
No, you got it backwards, John. It's not loss of Q. It's loss of center frequency. If you move a couple thousandths of an inch on that rod, the lost tangent of the supporting structure. You may have a chunk of plastic supporting the semiconductor at the high voltage end away from the ground, and now whether or not that particular piece of plastic with a high voltage on it has a loss tangent that'll give you a loss mechanism that can lower the Q. You can see it's a weird mixture, these cavity filters. You want very high quality dielectric materials at the high voltage end. You want very high quality conductive materials at the short circuit end. There are guys who will simply take the short circuit end at the bottom and screw it onto the copper pipe. And by those flat copper joints with copper oxide, they can end up having a very unreliable filter that all they've got to do is tap on it. All they've got to do is tap on it with a screwdriver, and it jumps to another frequency with another Q. So the quality of the grounding in milliohms at the bottom end, the quality of the dielectric constant at the high end, you follow those rules and you'll get all the performance. Ain't that crazy? KC2WGB, K2RAW at the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. Okay, so it sounds like we need some Teflon material at the top, and I do have silver solder capabilities here, no problem with that. Good. And I think when I do get it aligned, I will make a temperature check by leaving it outside at low temperature, bring it in, make measurements, then warm it up and make measurements and see how much drift I get. That should keep me close to the ballpark.
You've got it, John, and you see the theory of operation. So once you understand what's going on inside, that the loops are magnetically coupling to that semiconductor because there's a lot of strong magnetic field down at the short circuit end. The high voltage end with the plunger is just electronically changing the length to tune the center frequency. The whole structure is a piece of coaxial transmission line with the lowest possible loss you can make, and that's where the high Q comes from, the signal bouncing back and forth in resonance. That's where the Q comes from. Once you realize a couple of the basic theories of operation, it is not rocket science. Anybody can build this. But now when we find the right construction article, you'll give yourself another leg up of avoiding a few of the pitfalls of particular construction techniques. You'd be amazed how many guys don't quite understand the theory of operation. And the bottom plate, they just simply bent over some tabs on it and screwed it into the 4-inch diameter outer conductor. Just bent over some copper tabs and screwed it in. Schematically, it looks beautiful. To an untrained eye, it looks beautiful. To a guy who understands VHF, UHF circuits, he knows that there's milliohms of impedance at the short circuit end, and he looks at those overlapping joints of copper oxide held down with screws as the short circuit end, and you rapidly realize how you can end up with a very unreliable filter where one day it works great, you tap on it with a wooden screwdriver, and all of a sudden it jumps to some other frequency or some other Q. Or the temperature coefficient, as you change the temperature, your flat bottom piece of copper with its bent over tab screwed down move a few thousandths of an inch as a function of temperature. It changes the contact resistance on the overlapping joints with the
repeater. Time out.
It changes the overlapping joints, the number of milliohms, and therefore the thing goes and tunes itself to some other frequency at some other Q. You can see how what looks like an extremely good contact with screws could really be terrible once you understand the theory of operation. You'd be amazed how many guys have fallen into that minefield, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I could imagine. And also, you know, between you and I will also touch base with Eric. He might be able to point me in a direction to get some of the materials I need. I don't think it will be a problem. I just hope this is something I'll be able to do. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, for you to build it, John, is a definite possibility. But there's even the possibility that once you talk to Eric, find out what he's got in his junk box, so to speak. Talk to Andy, find out what he's got in his junk box. And while you're talking to each of those guys, they know a couple of other people who collect this kind of hardware. In my mind, there's a reasonably good chance that sitting in somebody's garage or basement is a cavity filter, sitting there for 5 years, a little bit tarnished on the outside. If you want it to look beautiful, you rub some Scotch-Brite on it, if you know what I mean, and maybe inspect it on the inside. But I think there's a reasonably good chance that somebody in the tri-state area has the cavity resonator filter for 2 meters that you're looking for, sitting there, gathering dust, doing nothing. You may not even have to build it once you talk to those two guys and have them suggest to you everybody else they know who collects this kind of hardware. There's a significant number of guys out there who look at this kind of hardware and say, gee, that's kind of pretty. He found it on the flea market for $15. He didn't really need it. He bought it, he put it in his garage, and it's sitting there. And you've got to find that guy. I think what you're looking for might already exist, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet. Leo.
Well, Dick, you might be right. Either way, difficult to build. And once I have a decent idea, after we do the general target area, then you must come in with a test that we know the test out. I think it's a good problem. Interesting, you said I could make the outer longer, because then I could make the adjustment plate something that's inserted in the top. And then fix my good motion of the rod and my stick down. Yeah, I might be doing it. Go ahead and just take a break.
Very fine, John. Heard everything you said. I don't know if Richard's going to make it, but let's give it a try. N2EO, give it a try. I'll see if you can get through. Thanks for all I got. You can try it.
I built it out of copper pipe from a plumbing supply house. I know what you're referring to, the plunger and the wrench. And later on, I had a cavity silicated, a Joe Reiser cavity, W1JR. And the only thing that made the preamps, who published the article for preamps in the Air Media magazine using transistor and a Pomona
repeater. Time out.
With the cap.
You copied much of that, Dick. I don't know if you did.
Yes, I did copy. What are you saying? So he has built cavity filters, and he was drilling them particularly for the Joe Reiser technique for building low noise amplifiers. See, in the case of a low noise amplifier, you've got a slightly similar problem. That is to say, you've got a signal coming down the antenna from, let's say, 432 megacycles. You want to pass it through a filter because you might have a whole lot of UHF taxicabs in the area and other things that are going to jam your front end. So you want to have the highest Q cavity filter you can have on the front end of your low noise amplifier. So you want to do a lot of selectivity, and you want to have very low insertion loss, because every decibel of insertion loss of your input filter into your low noise amplifier adds a dB of noise figure to the amplifier. So you got a conflict of interest there. So you'd be amazed how many guys have ended up building a great big mechanical structure for the input resonator and impedance matcher going from their antenna into the first transistor of their low noise amplifier. Very similar problem. You have to use low loss materials, and you got to dedicate some real estate if you want to have low insertion loss but sharp enough filtering. Okay, so I'm reasonably sure there's a good chance you're going to find somebody with the cavity filter you're looking for, one, two, three, four of them, sitting in a garage.
I'm a brief question.
Go ahead, John, with your question.
Okay, Dick, now, when it comes to the testing, do I use the sweep function generator with markers, or should I use two separate generators and then look examine the output on the spectrum analyzer? What would you recommend?
Multiple ways of doing it. I'm pretty sure that a properly calibrated sweep oscillator is the best, because when it's set up correctly, you're getting a continuous real-time photograph on that screen of what is the real passband of the system, what frequencies are coming through, what frequencies are being rejected. You'll see the curve move up and down with insertion loss. You'll see it move left and right with tuning. You'll see it get broader and narrower with a coupling coefficient. So sweeper is probably the best, John. Now, to do it correctly, you have to set things up a little bit carefully to make sure that there's a 50-ohm input impedance and a 50-ohm output impedance that the filter sees. If the filter, while you're testing it, sees some other crazy impedance, then during the time that you're testing it, it'll give you one performance, and when you put it in the real world, it'll give you another performance. You'd be amazed how many people are falling into that trap. When you're using very sharp filters, it's possible for the impedance that the filter sees to pull the filter to a slightly different frequency, a slightly different insertion loss, and the notch that you're going to be tuning for on the side. Once you choose the right cavity filter and tune it correctly, let me drop. Not only is it going to have a very nice band pass, but there's also going to be on the skirt on one side a sharp notch, which is rejecting the frequency you don't care, and will have almost no effect on the passband center frequency that you do intend to pass. And as you change the impedance that the coupling loops see, the notch will move, the passband will move in frequency and a little bit in amplitude. So as long as you've got the right instrumentation to set up a sweeper, just be a little bit careful about making sure the filter sees 50.0 ohms resistive on each connector while you're doing the testing. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yes, it does, Dick. Complete sense. Okay, now I assume 700 KC, 800 KC sweep would reveal the lobes well enough, and also any additional problems that might be. Oh, well, there shouldn't be, actually. Yeah, 700 kilohertz should probably be enough.
The exact amount of sweep you sweep is not critical. Whether you set it up for 70 kc of sweep, 700 kc of sweep, 1.5 megahertz of sweep, with your calibrator signals, your little tips that appear on the screen, because your sweep generator has got a built-in cal function, that can all become nice and quantitative on the oscilloscope screen. So those are minor details as I see it, John. And there's a whole art and science to properly setting up a sweep signal generator into the device under test, into a detector, into an oscilloscope, and the oscilloscope properly synchronized to the sweeping of the sweeper. There's a little bit of art and science to properly setting that up. But that's the most pleasurable way of doing it. Man is a visual animal. And when you get a nice picture of what you're seeing, you've got it made. Picture what the poor guys had to do when Brown and Woodward spent a man year of their life with a slotted line, and each time they moved the slotted line to the peak and the valley and measured the exact number of centimeters of location of the peak and the valley and go to their slide rule, and 10 minutes of calculation gives them one dot on the chart for one particular diameter of radiator at one particular length of radiator. Each time they go through the 10-minute procedure, they get one dot on the screen. Whereas with a modern day, with a modern day vector network analyzer, the whole Don curve from stem to skirt to stern on that screen appears every 30 milliseconds with a vector network analyzer. And each one of the 50 or 150 dots of one particular curve required 10 minutes of calculation when they did it in their day. And now you and I see a man day's worth of work of one particular curve. You and I see it displayed 30 times per second on a vector network analyzer. And as you change the variable capacitor, you watch the curve crawl on that screen. Every time they changed a variable capacitor, they had to go and plot 150 points all over again to find out what happened. Ain't that crazy, what they went through? And what's amazing to me is all of that work, which is so damn valuable if you know what you're looking at. It's in Chapter 4 of all four issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek and Johnson and Velasic. Chapter 4 has that curve. The modern-day antenna engineers don't know that that valuable data exists. Wild. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
Very good, Dick. And, you know, being we're both the same age, when we used to plot the curves for the anticipators, we had to do it that way, with a voltmeter, current meter. Oh, God. And, well, we would work with maybe 60 points at that time. Yeah, that's laborious. What a pain in the neck. But I know exactly what you're talking about. Very good. I'll let you go on and pick up someone else, and maybe we can get some more interesting things discussed. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And do we help, Dick? Go on.
Okay, I think this guy is going back home, Rich, so hang in there. And so until he gets a little bit weaker, and then we'll go back over to the comment that you're making, Rich, and we should be able to hear you. Because that vector network analyzer gives you a real-time display in real time, in other words, there wasn't even any flicker on the screen. 30 frames per second were being displayed on that screen. Each one of the curves on the screen, and I could plot as many as four curves at once in four different colors, input standing wave ratio, output standing ratio, forward transfer characteristic, reverse transfer characteristic, four separate colors, four separate curves on the screen, each of the four curves, every one of the dots, 150 equivalent dots, being updated 30 times per second. What an amount of data in a short amount of time being displayed on a modern-day vector network analyzer. With that tool, while you're tuning an antenna, let me drop it. With that tool, as you're tuning an antenna, you've got a thin, long wooden stick in your hand and a small piece of copper at the end of it. And you're moving that piece of copper near the right-hand side of director number one, the right-hand side of director number two, the middle of the right-hand side of the driven element, or the middle of the right-hand side of the reflector. As you're moving your tuning tool near the various elements of the antenna you're tuning, and you watch the screen, all of that data, a megabyte of data is being updated 30 times per second in real time as you're making the change. When you do that as a real ham radio antenna tinkerer, so to speak, it allows you to find things that no one else has ever seen. You suddenly realize that, hey, if I make that director a little bit higher in frequency, at the same time I make the reflector a little bit lower in frequency, all of a sudden the gain stays flat, but the standing wave ratio jumps down to a great big low number over a whole lot of megacycles. And you say, boy, that's an interesting tuning characteristic. Bet no one's ever seen that before. Now you know how some of those patents on some of those antennas was derived by seeing it in real time. You try to go to a computer modeling program to try to model that Yagi I'm describing at 900 megacycles. You try to give it all the data as to the physical layout of all the stuff on that antenna. Let me drop. Guys, you try to give the modeling program all of that data as to what the new physical arrangement is because you've moved something. And you try to put all that physical data into the modeling program, and you press go, and you wait half an hour, and it comes up with a partial solution to the answer you're looking for. As opposed to doing it in real time with a real tuning tool, with a real network analyzer, and the answer that you're looking for is displayed in a 30th of a second because of the change you've made. You're seeing it happen in real time while you're moving the curve, while you're moving the tool. And there are times where, as you move the tool between antenna director number one and director number two, and in the intermediate position that you never even intended to try, while the tool was in motion, you saw something happen on that screen and say, whoa, let's go back to that. That was damn desirable. I just saw a sudden notch move through the center of that antenna pattern. Wow. I never would have guessed that it does that. When you're doing it in real time with modern day equipment, you can find all kinds of stuff that no one's ever seen before. That's where 30 patents came from, 30 patent applications came from, 22 of which have already been issued. Over to you, John, for a comment if you want. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yeah, it really is great. And, you know, in our time, Dick, we had slide rules, which worked very well and very accurate to three digits. Can you imagine someone like Hertz or Tesla, which didn't even have slide rules in those days, had the equipment we have today? I wonder what they would have developed. Can you just think about how much more advanced we would be? Just fascinating stuff. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to give you one more piece of information as to what that network analyzer is doing. Let's just talk about the input standing wave ratio measurement on the J1 connector coming out of the front panel of the analyzer. It goes over to your antenna. And you go through a calibration procedure where you have it sweep across the frequencies you care about. You first put a perfect 50-ohm load on the end of your test cable. Then you put a perfect short circuit. You put a perfect open circuit. And each time you put that calibration device on the end of the cable, you press go. You tell the network analyzer in the calibrate mode, I just put on the short circuit, sweep through those 1,024 frequencies. Sweep through 1,024 frequencies, measure the amplitude and phase that you see as the reflection when I've got a perfect 50-ohm load. Then I'm going to put a short circuit, look at the amplitude and phase at those 1,024 frequencies. Then I'm going to put an open circuit, look at the amplitude and phase of the reflection of those 1,024 frequencies. It puts all of that into its calibration spreadsheet, I'm going to call it. It goes through a whole bunch of calculations. It's called the 12-point calibration procedure. For each individual dot on the screen, it's going to a lookup table saying that this is the insertion loss, this is the reflection coefficient, this is the phase angle that saw when Dick put his real antenna on there. But because of the calibration procedure we went through, I have to increase this one a little bit, decrease this one a little bit, change the phase angle of this one before I put that particular dot on the screen. And it does that for 1,024 dots on each individual sweep, 30 times per second, in real time, while I'm changing the antenna. It's doing all of the calibration reverse procedure. It's taking out any of the...
Repeater, timeout.
Any of the idiosyncrasies of my particular test cable. My particular test cable has got a bunch of glitches to it. It's got a connector on the end that's got a little bit of a Viswar jump, dump, and whatever. During the calibration procedure, the machine found out all of that, put all of that data into its calibration spreadsheet, and now when it displays my real data, it cranks back out all of the characteristics of that test cable. It's as if I'm connecting the device of the test directly to the front. It's as if I'm connecting the antenna of the test directly to the input connector on the front of the analyzer. I can't do that. When I'm building a 900 megacycle Yagi antenna that takes up a square foot of area, there's no way I can put it directly on the front panel of that analyzer because the sheet metal and the display and everything else nearby would disturb the living daylights out of the antenna. I'm putting it on the end of 4 feet of high-quality test cable. But the test cable has got a personality that has to be taken back out. Insertion loss, visual reflections, and whatever.